Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the Retro Remix podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Hi, Denise. Welcome to the Retro Remix podcast.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Just great.
So excited to talk to you. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I live in Iowa and I work in higher education in my day job, but How to Fail at Flirting is my debut novel. It's the first book that's going to be published. It's actually the first book I've written, except for one NaNoWriMo project that I don't really talk about because it will never see the light of day. I grew up as a military brat, so I've kind of spent my whole life transitioning from place to place, and writing was kind of always a constant. I could always sort of create these spaces and these worlds and these people that were with me. And so I think I've carried that into adulthood.
I love it. So what inspired you to start writing?
I've really always written. I joke that in my bio, my first book was called I Hate You and its sequel, I Still Hate You, which I think I wrote in the second grade. But I've always loved to craft stories. Like when I was a little kid, like laying in my bed or even playing with my paper dolls, they had these very elaborate soap opera style telenovelas happening when I was a kid. And so I just always did that. It was always an escape. And then when I went to graduate school, that really shifted to academic writing. My research is in higher education, particularly with student veterans and then with students of color. And those are the things I teach about. And so then it's looking at theory and research and data. And so really, that's where my writing shifted for a long time. And then when I had my son 4 years ago, I had just returned to work. I felt like I was momming and working 24/7, and I just needed a creative outlet. And so I sat down to just write what I thought was going to be a short story about ex-boyfriends. And some of the characters in the book actually were based on some ex-boyfriends of mine. And so I just was having sort of fun with it. And then it became this really wonderful way to kind of rediscover myself, to get back in touch with my creativity, and just to feel like I was creating something besides new life. And so that's really what inspired me to start writing. I didn't have a plan. I didn't really know the craft of fiction writing, but it's sort of just fun. And then I just kept going and I ended up with a book that's about 40,000 words longer than what the book currently is, because I didn't know what I was doing. But then I started getting feedback from people and friends and found writing communities. And that's kind of how the book started to take shape. And I realized, hey, this could really be something that other people might want to read.
I love that. And I love the book. So we're going to talk a little bit briefly about that. I got a question. So what was your PhD thesis about?
My dissertation was on student veterans and their transition experiences into college settings. And so I did a survey of students at 14 institutions, and we looked at how their first their reflections on their first year. And then I looked at that from a variety of angles and then talked about how colleges and universities can work with their programs and services to meet needs of students.
That's fascinating. I love this. I love, you know, because that was my old career. I'm fascinated. Uh-huh. I like how people, you know, study different things about college and universities and student experience and how they take them and look at the different populations. It's so interesting. So
completely. And even just thinking about whose experiences are looked at and whose aren't. And when I started, at least, I think the research has had a big uptick in the last 5-10 years, is folks were not looking at military students as student veterans. There was very little research on folks after the, you know, the 70s, up until even really like 2008, folks started researching again, in a big way. And so just thinking about whose stories are told and who do we build programs on. And I think we see that in book worlds too, you know, whose stories get told.
Yeah, that is so fascinating. So you taught a romance course for the university. Tell us all about it. Why would you pay attention to romance?
So looking at the course that I taught, really started out as kind of a joke with a friend. We have an honors program on our campus, and they have the students take one credit courses, and they're really meant to be very discussion oriented, to get the honors students, these kind of high achieving, high ability students, into thinking about lots of different things and in lots of different ways. And so I love romance, and a friend of mine who works with the program is a fairly recent romance convert. And so we talk about romance all the time. And we said, you know, we should, and we were just talking about crushing the patriarchy one day, as we just tend to do randomly. And said, you know, what if we taught a class on this? And I was like, yeah, that would be funny. And she's like, no, do it. The proposals are due next week. And so I made her do it with me. And we just decided to teach this class for the 14 students, really just getting them to think about what it meant to examine patriarchy through romance novels. And for most of our students in class, they don't or hadn't read romance novels, at least not many, and had many of those preconceived notions that many people come to romance with. And so that was really exciting for them to just get experience with the genre and to apply. So I think really wonderful skills in rhetorical analysis and really deep dive of content to what they were reading and experiencing. So as I am one to do, I announced that we were doing that on Twitter, and the reaction was huge. And so we said, okay, well, we'll offer it online. I didn't know how we were going to do that, but we just committed to it. I expected maybe 50 people. I think about 600 people signed up. Mm-hmm. So they got weekly emails, just really summarizing what we talked about in class. Sometimes we had interviews with some authors, some resources, like things to read, websites to go to, some book recommendations that we crowdsourced from the romance reading and writing community. And then we did weekly chats where really we just post questions. I'm certainly not the expert. We had many experts that joined us on the chat, but it was just a time and space for people to come together. And so that was a really cool kind of merging of worlds. And those types of classes exist kind of all over the romance sphere, again, with people who are much more well-versed in the history of it than me. But that was, for me, a really neat way to connect in a kind of an academic way with why I love romance.
I love it. So let's talk about your writing. Do you follow an outline? Do you see where the story leads you?
Well, with How to Fail at Flirting, I think I shared earlier, I just sat down and started writing things. Okay. There was no outline. There was no plan. Once editing got started, there was more of a plan. But now I usually start with my outline and my beat sheet, and I'm very intentional about mapping things out up to about the 50% mark of the book. And then I get bored with outlining and start writing, and then forget I was supposed to be outlining until I get to about the 80% mark. And then I go back and backfill it. So I guess that makes me a plantster, something like that. But I have all of those. They're in my head, but getting it all the way done before I start writing doesn't usually happen.
I love this. How do you organize yourself? How do you organize yourself as a writer? How do you keep track of your ideas, inspirations, and characters?
Yeah, I don't know if I do anything too original. I'm a big Scrivener fan. That's what I usually use instead of Word. And so anytime I have an idea or a plot bunny, or I participate in all the Kissing's Friday Kiss posts, where you just post, you know, 280 characters related to a theme. And sometimes I get an inspiration for a new book from those. But I just start a new Scrivener file and write down kind of whatever I know, and then just leave it there. And as other ideas come to me, I kind of just save everything in that place. So when I'm ready to come back to the idea, I do. Some people are really great at making aesthetics and having pictures of the characters in front of them. And I really don't do that. I think even when you read my books, I don't spend a lot of time describing my characters. As a reader, I really like to envision who I want to envision. So that's kind of how I write. So though I have Henry Cavill in my head for Jake, for example, for this book, you know, somebody else might have somebody different. So I don't usually do anything like that, but I do just put all my notes kind of in those files. I think there's about 45 files that are started on my computer of ideas that are just lingering there.
I love this. Do you share your work along the way, or do you wait just complete it for others to read?
I have no chill with sharing my work. So I have a few critique partners. Allison Ashley, who wrote Perfect Distraction that came out in February, her and I just have a running DM. And so she sees scenes, especially like the steamy scenes, almost as soon as I write them. So I have a few trusted people who I share things with along the way, but otherwise, I kind of have different folks who I go to at different points in the story.
I love this. What was your journey to get that first book published?
You know, I think as journeys go, mine was a fairly smooth one. I probably worked on the book for about 6 months, and then I had what I thought was a great draft, and then I showed it to some friends and realized, oh, nope, not great. Did some editing. I found a writing community, and I probably did another maybe 8 months to a year of editing as kind of getting in and learning more. And then at that point, I thought I really was planning to self-publish it, or even to put it out on like Wattpad or something like that. And a friend introduced me to querying, and I pretended I knew what that was, and then I Googled it because I was, again, just very kind of green to all of this, and learned more about that, and then decided, okay, well, I'll give this a try. I'm an academic, so I dug into some research and learned about agents and manuscript wish list and different publishers and how to do all of this. I queried agents for about 3 months. And I participated in DV Pit, which if there are writers listening for marginalized identities, was the best experience. It is ultimately how I connected with my agent, but more than that, it's how I connected with other writers, particularly other writers of color. And it was so supportive that I left that day feeling like I could do anything. And I was not one of the rock stars who got 1,000 likes and had every single agent on the planet interested in the book. But it was just that idea of finding your community, which I think is so huge in any endeavor, but especially in a creative endeavor. And then signed with my agent. I think we were out on submission and did editing probably for a couple of months. And so really from querying to signing the book deal was from October to April or May, something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my journey, and I feel really lucky to end up at Berkeley. I really love my editor, Carrie Donovan, at Berkeley, and then my agent, Sharon Pelletier at Distel, Gutterick, and Borat is fantastic and just someone who I really feel like I can go to and trust. And so that process for me was really smooth, and I feel like ended up in a really great way.
I'm excited. I'm excited for How to Follow 40. So let's talk about it. So what was that source of inspiration?
So the inspiration for the book, I don't know if there was really one place where that inspiration came from. I mentioned that it really started out, the main character would be an academic. At the time, I hadn't read a lot of romances that took place in academia or with academic folks in academic careers at the center. Of course, there are many. I just hadn't read many at the time. But I knew that would be the case. And I thought it was going to be funny, which I think it did end up being funny, but it was going to be about ex-boyfriends. Her best friend, Erin, in the book was based on, again, an ex of mine. And so that's just where I started writing the story. And I thought it would be kind of funny and light. And then as I started writing it, I really started thinking about, and this was at a time in the news where there was just a lot of doubt around higher education. I think there still is, but what do we do at colleges and universities? What's our goal? What does it mean to be a professor? How misunderstood is what that role is from folks who are outside the academy? And so as I started looking about that, I also started thinking about how do I show this character as a three-dimensional person? She is a professor, but also a person, as you know all professors are, and you know, dealing with her own things. And that is where kind of her personality and her history started to evolve. The meet cute with the hero Jake actually came from being on a business trip with some friends and a guy at a bar kind of hitting on us. It wasn't original, and it certainly wasn't a love story, but I did just start to think, and I was already writing the kind of crafting the book and thinking, you know, what if you met somebody like that, but it was just this instant connection? And that's never happened in my life, but you know, maybe that like cheesy line and that kind of silly, you know, pickup story in that instant is just what you needed to hear. And so I was joking with my friends as we had a couple drinks, and I went back to the room and kind of just sketched out that meet cute in my hotel in Texas. And so that part kind of shaped it there.
Love this. And so Naya has been focusing on her career, and so her relationship had taken a back burner because she had an abusive relationship that led her to just do that. And her friends pushed her out of her comfort zone, you know, by making a list and just doing this whole thing of how to fail for a, you know, why was it important to share Naya getting out of her comfort zone to fall in love?
I think in part because she looks at where she is as kind of a comfort zone, but I think she also sees it as a rut. Mm-hmm. It's simultaneously safe and claustrophobic for her to be closed in the way she is. But I also think that for her, what she doesn't see maybe until the book later in the book is that that's a safety response for her. That's a self-defense mechanism. That's a way to protect herself from hurt. And so I think that this character couldn't fall in love until she took the risk to step outside that bubble, because for her, that bubble is very much a protective one of not letting anybody in. And so I knew for the love story to happen, that would have to be the case. But I also know that a type A person, I might be one, mm-hmm. That a list of things to accomplish is, for me, the number one way to get me to do something. Yeah. And I think her friends know that about her. They kind of joke about that. But I think she knows that about herself. And so, you know, there's a point where she is sitting at a bar and thinking, okay, I have this list that was a joke to get myself, you know, out there in the world, but maybe this could work. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that is, for her, is ignoring all the other things she needs to work on, but that's sort of part of her personality too. And so that for me is why how the list took shape. And I don't know if the list was actually part of my first draft. I think as I started to get to know the character, I thought, you know what, this character would not just step out there on her own. That would not be what she would do. And so this list, which originally has to do with facetiously kind of hooking up with a guy, is also for her about, you know, how do I get my life back? How do I get my voice back? And in some ways, how do I find the voice I've never raised at all?
Yeah, I can identify with the list because I think for me, that's how I got out of the comfort zone, how to get the rut out of it. It's like basically making lists of like, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to try this, or I'm going to meet this person, or I'm just going to, like, it pushes you out of that comfort zone and it gets you out of the rut. So I love it. I love books that deal with lists, you know, for type of personalities. So it's like, it just gets you out of the rut. So you mentioned a little bit briefly about hierarchization and department cuts. And so, you know, especially now with like schools going virtual, there's like money's getting tight and all different things. And there's a lot of questioning about hierarchization. And so Naya's department works in education, which is, you know, I think it's one of those departments that often gets cut because it's not sexy, it's not business, it's not engineering. Even though Naya
entrepreneurial.
And Naya teaches like math education with STEM, which is like, you know, looking at that, what, you know, I really love this premise. Why was it important to show, you know, this part of the process of hard education, you know, that is just like that dirt. It's a struggle. It's a struggling, you know.
There's a lot of reasons. Part of that was just, you know, looking at what conflict would be meaningful for mm-hmm. her. And her job being threatened is incredibly meaningful for her because that's really where she's put everything.
Yeah.
But I think too about, and I'm circling back a little bit. When I had early folks read it, one of the folks who read this for me was my major professor, like my advisor from when I got my PhD. And while everybody else had asked about the love story and the friendships and some of the relationships, the first thing she said when we sat down to talk about the book is, does she have tenure or not? And then that kind of got me thinking about, it's not like I didn't know that tenure was important and really shapes a professor's role at an institution and her power and influence. But that got me thinking about why was that helpful to show that and show that there's these different power dynamics kind of in this institution. Also that for education, I worked with our College of Education for 5 years in my last job working with students specifically in elementary education or who were pursuing math education or something like that, who were students of color, and where they saw that those jobs were going to be valued and where they saw that they weren't. And that's no shock to anybody. I think that teachers are often not as valued as they need to be and should be. But that extends to other places too. So at this institution, they're really shifting their resources toward business and engineering, and those are the priorities. And so working in education is kind of being in this tenuous place of knowing your work is important, but also feeling like you have to constantly defend why the work matters. Her department is underfunded. They're in the really rundown building and those sorts of things. And so for her, that's part of that being unsteady in her work, but she also is really driven to math education by her grandfather, who was an immigrant, but whose first language was Spanish. And so part of her research is looking at how math education affects English language learners or folks who English isn't the language, primary language spoken at home. And so her family connection really speaks to the work that she does too. And for so many people doing that work, that exists and that's real. And it really is a way to link identity issues and social justice issues and education and career. And for her, those are all things that are kind of swirling in the background. They're not part of the core love story, but they're part of the core character. Mm-hmm. And so all of that, that is all really just to say that her work and her identity are really tied together. So she's doing these things to kind of get out of her rut and redefine her identity. It was really important for me for her job to be critical to that at all points in the story.
I love this. So Naya got out of an abusive relationship, which is a big feat. What was the research part that research like to get this part right? Because it just demonstrated, you know, the lingering effects of an abusive relationship and still, like, you know, having the person come back to your life. Yeah,
and I'll share that is not, I definitely did a lot of research because that is not my story. I know that I am lucky that that's not been my experience. And I say lucky because I think that is one of the key determinants if somebody is in that abusive space or experiencing that harassing space or not. At least at this point in my life, I think I've been lucky to not. For me, it was doing a lot of reading. When I was an undergraduate, I did coursework in psychology was my major, and I had a minor in sociology. And so I did a number of courses where we talked about trauma and healing. And then in my master's program and a bit in my PhD, took classes on counseling, helping skills, and part of that is looking at trauma. And then in some of the work I've done, there's always been a lot of training on working with people who are in different situations and understanding referrals to different resources. And so that's been a part of it. Talking to different people, talking to folks who work in like survivor advocacy and going to a lot of sessions. So that is part of what my research was. The other piece was having a number of people read it and, you know, tell me, this is a fit, or this feels off, or this response seems odd. I think that the, I don't know if it's the challenge in writing healing, but people heal in so many different ways, that it was making sure for me that it was consistent to the character, but also, you know, really trying my best to do no harm. And I hope I did that. But to show what I think is a fairly honest journey of somebody who doesn't think they're healing and then realizes they need to. And also that people can, you know, that you can fall in love and have good sex and be great at your job and still be suffering from trauma, and that all of those other things don't negate the trauma. That for me was important to show, that even though she's having this sort of romantic transformation and finding things about herself, but that doesn't negate this trauma that she has in her past and this healing that she continues to do.
I love this. So I love that you said this book in Chicago. And just a side note, I just moved to Chicago pre-pandemic. So yay. I'm like all about reading books set in a place that I'm fairly gut experience. So what was the process like just to set the book, like, you know, have the setting, you know, in Chicago where you don't live? Like, you know, did you put it? What was that process like?
Yeah, and I'm so sad because I had a whole trip planned to Chicago this summer, which of course did not happen. But I live in Iowa, and I knew I probably wasn't going to set the book here. Actually, initially, it was in Texas, and then they did a road trip all over the country. It was a mess. But I always knew she was from Chicago, and in part, Naya grew up in Iowa in a small town, and some of that ties to... There's a little bit in the book about how she's kind of reconnecting with her racial and ethnic identity. Yep. And part of that was growing up in a small town and her family feeling like they had to blend in. And so her not having that. And so I knew she had kind of grown up in this small town. But Chicago is a good connection point, I think, from Iowa, that a lot of folks who are in Iowa go to Chicago, or you recruit a lot of people from Illinois here. And so for me, that kind of just felt natural. I've never lived in Chicago. I want to. But the times I've visited, for me, it's a city that just is very authentic and feels like a Midwestern city, but also feels like a city. And I thought for Naya, that would be a really good space to be. I don't fully know why I put the hero in North Carolina. I think I just had been wanting to go somewhere that wasn't Iowa and was warm. So I put him in Raleigh. We don't spend a whole lot of time there in the story. But I love that all the different things and settings that could be in Chicago. And we don't really see, I think, a lot of the city in the book. Mm-hmm. Being the workaholic she is, you're in her office on her campus a lot. And then they're at Navy Pier because she doesn't, she wants to be somewhere very public and kind of impersonal. And so you sort of see the city as a tourist, I think, a little bit.
Yeah, it just felt like, as someone who's, like, not just learning to explore Chicago, like, briefly, it's like, oh, like, there's this Hancock building, or, you know, there's the Navy Pier. Like, it's a touristy spot, but it makes sense because she's, like, it's a college town, too. There's a lot of colleges in Chicago, so work is just around the college, you know, so.
You know, and I also like to think, this isn't in the book, but it's sort of just in my head, that, though when she was kind of younger and living in the city, she would have explored a lot in this idea of sort of closing herself off. That's really been kind of physically closing herself off too, that I have work and I have home and I have my friends home and I have my very set spots that I go to. But I don't think that for the last several years, she's been in a place where she was, you know, finding her favorite nooks in the city. And I think physically she was probably fairly cloistered, but part of the touristy part of the beginning is she pretends that she's a tourist. That's part of that. I'm going to be safe. You don't need to know anything about me. I'll just pretend I don't live here. And so then, you know, he thinks they're both tourists and having this lovely little exploration of tourist traps. And, but I do think in my head, as the story kind of moves on after the book, part of that would just be exploring the city too and finding her place in it.
Yeah, that's exciting. So what's next for you?
Well, I just turned in my second book, which will be out next fall. There'll be a teaser chapter in the back of How to Fail at Flirting. This one is called The Fastest Way to Fall. Had a thing with Fs, I guess. And this one is about Britta, who is a journalist. She's a fat heroine. And she, as a way to work up at the lifestyle magazine that she works at, has an opportunity to review an app that's kind of like Noom. A fitness app that has with coaching. And it's not really something she very much cares about, but she makes the point that, you know, as a fat person, I'm probably somebody who they're targeting, but also our magazine is very focused on wellness and we're focused on reaching your goals. And the point she makes at the beginning that was important to me is being a fat person who wants to do this and be interested in fitness is not a political statement that I want to change myself. And so the magazine green lights it and she starts on this journey and is very sure this is going to be kind of her ticket to being a feature, working in features at the magazine. And of course it's a romance. So she falls for her coach who's virtual and he actually ends up being the owner of the company. So he has his own thing. It's dual perspective. It's a little bit more of a slow burn. If there's ever been an own voices story for me, it is this one. And I really love these characters, so I hope people really love them too.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait. I have a thing for plus size heroines because I'm plus size. Like, I look for those and look for the representation. So I'm so excited for this book.
I will say with this one, she starts running. That's part of her, the fastest way to fall is she starts running. And I don't run. And so I did a lot of research on that as I was eating Cheetos and writing about running on my couch. But yeah, it was really fun to write about sort of her journey, and it's, she's falling in love with the hero, but I think she's also falling in love with her body and what it can do and being good with who she is and what she looks like. And it's really the whole focus of the app and the hero is not on you have to change. It's, you know, what do you want to do? How do you want to move? Mm-hmm. What do you want to accomplish? And so that's really the story. So I'm very excited about that. And now I'm working on, since that's turned in, working on some other just ideas that have been percolating.
Oh, this is so exciting. I can't wait. Now let's go to a random book recommendation. This is an opportunity for you to share with the audience what this year next. What is your favorite genre?
Oh, romance. Favorite genre by far, romance. That's most of what I read. Even when I was a pretentious college and graduate student and thought, oh, I'm better than that, which is ridiculous. What I always was most interested in any other book I was reading was the love story. And if it didn't have it, I was usually skimming. So yeah, definitely romance. I love particularly contemporary romance. Mm-hmm. Really contemporary writing just in general is generally more my jam than historical. But yeah, I'm a happily ever after, bring on the kissing kind of reader.
What has been some books that you read that you love?
I think some I've read this year that I love that were romance. Island Affair by Priscilla Olivares takes place in Key West, and it was a complete escape in May when we were, you know, on month two of quarantine or whatever it was. Queen Move by Kennedy Ryan just left me shook. It was just lovely and sexy, and I just loved everything about that book. So those were two romances that I really loved. There were many more. I could talk for days. Mm-hmm. I had a series this fall called How My Friends Failed at Flirting. And so I had a number of authors on, like Rosie Dannon, who wrote The Roommate, Jen DeLuca, who wrote Well Played and Well Met that came out last year, Jane Agaro, who wrote Ties That Tether. So a lot of my friends there, and those books have all been amazing. And then just last night, well, really this morning, because I stayed up till 3 a.m. reading it, was The White Coat Diaries by Maddie Sinha, which isn't a romance so much as women's fiction, but it's I think it's billed as Grey's Anatomy meets Scrubs, and it's all about this woman's sort of intern year, and as she deals with kind of her own things around expectations and family and culture, and it was fantastic. So that one was out in September 15th when that one comes out.
Oh, this is so exciting. Thank you, Denise, for being on the show. Oh, tell us where we can find you online.
Oh, sure. I am on most active on Instagram and Twitter, but on Facebook as well. So on Instagram and Twitter, I'm at Nick Will Writes, which is NICWILLWRITES. And I think it's author Denise Williams on Facebook. And I'm really active on all those platforms, probably more than I should be because I should be writing and not on there. And then my website is DeniseWilliamsWrites.com.
Thank you, Denise, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, rate, and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Once you connect with fellow romance readers and make new friends, get weekly book recommendations, attend monthly meetups, then join our Patreon community. You can join at whatreadnextblog.com/Patreon. Romance lovers, check out Queen Bee Reads Etsy shop for cute and comfortable bookish apparel. The shop also features social justice apparel and fun items from some of your favorite TV shows like The Schitt's Creek and The Office. Use code WHATTORE10 to save. Visit whatreadnextblog.com/queenbeereads. What to Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Discover new podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcast. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyourreadsblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.